sometimes think nowadays there's very complex business models of how revenue will be generated, how profit will be generated, and how investors will get their money back. So if you can give them a really clear picture on this is when we will make money and this is how we make money, and it's straightforward, you're probably halfway there.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, as always, Gary Fox. This week is the final episode in season 8. That went by pretty quick, but we'll be back in a couple of weeks with season 9, so fear not. However, before I leave you, I've got an incredible chat to round out the season. Today, I'm chatting to Roseanne Longmore, the co-founder and CEO of CoreFlow. I'm going to make a very bullish prediction here. I rarely do this to such an extent, but I guarantee you, mark down CoreFlow in your notebook as a company to watch, because I guarantee you, in a couple of years' time, we're going to be looking back going, wow, that was Gary's chat with them in 2022. And now here they are a couple of years later, worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of euro. It's a big statement, but we'll look back in a couple of years and realize how correct I was, making a Gary B style prediction there. Joking aside, this is an incredible episode. We go deep into the practicalities of what it takes to raise a significant amount of funding in an early stage business, what their plans are, how they're going to roll it out, and how you build a world first device. They're building the first ever accurate breastfeeding measurement tool. This is no small feat. Now, before we kick on, here's a quick chat about my sponsor for season 8, Sage. As an entrepreneur, you need to be leveraging tools and software to run your business as smoothly and efficiently as possible. That is why I'm delighted to partner with Sage for this season of the pod. Sage is the global market leader for technology that helps small and medium businesses perform at their best. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. Roseanne, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to chat to you.
Thank you.
So, answer the awkward question I ask everybody at the start, what it is that you do?
I'm the CEO of CoreFlow, and CoreFlow have developed the world's first breastfeeding monitor. So essentially, the World Health Organization recommends that mothers exclusively breastfeed to 6 months. And in Ireland, about 13% of mothers get to the 6 month target. It's about 1% in the UK. And this similar trend is seen across the world, with the average in Europe of 13% of mothers reaching this target. So we kind of need to ask ourselves why do breastfeeding mothers stop sooner than they want to? And globally, the main reason given is for premature weaning is concern regarding low supply. So mothers don't know if their baby's getting enough milk, and they start to supplement or switch to formula entirely. So this is a very well-known problem, and there is really no solution. The existing method is pre- and post-feed weighing. So they weigh the baby before it's fed, and then they feed the baby and weigh it after it. And despite like widespread use, all studies show that this is highly inaccurate. So we went to look for a product, or develop a product that could tell a mother how much milk her baby's getting. So my co-founders are Jamie and Helen. Their first baby was only 2 kilos full term. So he was just tiny. He wasn't premature. And Helen really wanted to breastfeed. And she obviously was very, knew the importance of breastfeeding, especially for small babies. And the public health nurse was coming out and putting the baby on a weighing scales. And she was, you know, she's a doctor, and she was being, you know, told count the wet nappies, check for satiety signs. But there was no accuracy, and she was becoming very anxious. So Jamie, her husband, is an electronics engineer, and he was working in a different in flow sensing in a different industry. And they looked to the market to see, was there any product that can tell you how much milk the baby's getting? And none existed. So the Coro is actually a silicone nipple shield. So nipple shields are currently out in the market for skin protection, for to help with issues around oversupply. And you find them in any pharmacy. They're like 2 for 15 euro, and they're ultra thin silicone. So the concept of shields have been around since the 1500s. You know, in the past, they would have been glass, pewter, silver, leaves, animal skins. But nowadays, the ultra thin ones, they're made of silicone, and they're as thin as a contact lens. And essentially, our product has patented a microflow sensor that sits within a standard shield. So the mother wears it like a normal shield. And then as she feeds her baby normally, the data is sent to the app on her phone. So she can see in real time, accurate, precise information as to how much milk her baby is getting.
That is incredibly cool. That is such an incredible product. A beautiful explanation as well for someone that wouldn't be very familiar with the area. That is succinct. And I get it exactly. That's incredible. Like that is, but that's a big journey. Like to go from the initial problem to developing that, that must be a huge journey. So when did it all start?
So it started back around 2015 when Jamie and Helen had the idea, and Jamie was kind of developing the patent in the background and the technology, and Helen was working, you know, on the kind of the size of the market, particularly in terms of the medical, like the size of the medical and the clinical problem, and then, you know, the commercial like side of it. So globally, we'd say 60% of women stop breastfeeding sooner than they want to because of this problem. And it varies country to country, but not widely. So I was working in financial services, and Jamie's actually my cousin. So I was, you know, we're very close. I'm always over at their house. And I was kind of with them on this kind of journey of kind of like looking at the market. And then once the patent filed, we kind of agreed that, you know, we were a really good team because we had like the different skill set. Now, that was pretty organic, you know, experience. We didn't really put too much emphasis on it. But actually, once we went out to fundraise, we realized, yeah, people loved the variety in the team and the different, the engineering, the medicine, the finance. So our roles are pretty clear, and it just kind of happened organically. Like I love startups like Shark Tank, Dragon's Den. Like I always wanted to kind of build a company, and this was just the perfect opportunity because it was a really good idea and it was backed up with the patents and the technology. So I left my very secure, my very good job in 2017. Jamie and I went full time at CoralFlow. Yeah.
I think there's a really good lesson in that for entrepreneurs and founders, because that's constantly the thing. Oh, I have an idea, but I need a co-founder. And everyone's going to all these like networking events and they're like trying to force it. And inevitably, like from all the hundreds of people I've chatted to, it's always this organic thing that kind of go, well, they were just kind of interested, or they're my cousin or my brother or whoever it is. And it just happens, that organic, beautiful mix. You were just very lucky that the three of you had such high level of skills across complementary areas. What your background there, you mentioned previously, was in financial services. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I originally left school, like very traditional, like background school, and into a university. And I did a degree in public administration in University of Limerick, thinking I'd like to go into the civil service. And I did about 6 months after my degree, and I quickly realized this was not for me. So ended up in the world of wealth management and investment banking. So I was doing that for like nearly 15 years. And but like that, always just had a general interest in anything business. And I was dealing with a lot of high net worth clients, and really the ones that fascinated me the most were people who had built their own business. Mm. So not that kind of inherited wealth, or, you know, but people who had actually started companies. And yeah, it was always just something I wanted to do, but I certainly wasn't willing. I'm not so like risk taking that I would have left my job for any idea. You know, like it really was on the back of knowing Jamie and Helen so well, knowing their level of expertise, that I was willing to get on board and eventually took the jump.
You said you mentioned you're working with a lot of high net worth individuals. Was there kind of, by osmosis, was there characteristics you're watching in them? Was there things you're picking up from them, signs, signals in the market, and kind of watching their behaviors and characteristics that you then thought, okay, I can then apply that to my own business? Or was it just totally organic?
Well, I'm certainly not a high net worth now.
Yes.
But,
yes.
No, it was, yeah. But certainly in terms of when we went out to fundraise, we raised nearly €1 million like within 6 weeks of starting the fundraising. And I think maybe just my experience of being able to present and meet and speak to them, and having been used to that in a previous life, certainly helped. And maybe like understanding what type of questions they would have, because, you know, when I did my first pitch, you know, to an investor, I had never done that before, but like maybe I was just, I kind of understood their mindset and what they would be looking for, and how to, you know, how to speak about such a high risk seed investment. Because right back then we had the patent, but we had no working prototype. We had no other money. So I think just being able to talk to them at that level, that was probably a very helpful for my last job. But yeah, that's probably about it.
And when you were putting this together, what were the things you're going, okay, they're going to want to know this, this, and this, and this? Because this is a common question we get asked on the pod after people have been on and raised money. They're like, oh, but what were they looking for? What was the secret sauce? Everyone's looking for the secret sauce of what, why did they raise a million so quickly?
Yeah, for us, I think, and I think for other startups, to really focus on kind of two things. One would be they want to know the size of the market, but not just like a figure, you know, 10% of women in Ireland, so we'll do 10% of women across Europe. You know, they really want to see like very, I would say, like really good modeling of how you have built up your the size of the market, because it's kind of easy to pick out numbers and then just extrapolate it out across the world and suddenly everything is a billions of dollars market size. So I think to be able to defend that very, very aggressively and to understand your figures very carefully and the nuances between different geographies and different regions is vitally important. Probably the other thing is it's like asking the customer, you know, like really it sounds so boring a lot of the time you say to people market research, but a lot of the time there's so many solutions out there, but is there really a problem? Now, we were really lucky in that the problem that exists is very easy for investors to go out and investigate and ascertain. So they would say, okay, this is interesting, Roseanne, now I'm going to go out, and they go home and they might ask their sister or daughter or mother, whoever, you know, women they know. And then suddenly they're like, oh my God, this is a real problem. So like that was the simplicity of our product actually stood to us in that regard, because they could simply go out and ask women like, did you have this problem? Do you know anyone who experienced this problem? And then they would come back to me and say, oh, God, this is real, you know, and women would, female investors would know it's a problem. So the fact that it's critically felt really benefited us. And then, yeah, I mean, definitely the business model is the final thing I'd add to that. Like our business model is straightforward for investors to understand. They could say, OK, you walk into a pharmacy, you pick this up and you buy it. Like that, you can sell online. So the how we make money is straightforward for them to understand. And I sometimes think nowadays there's very complex business models of how people will get their how revenue will be generated, how profit will be generated, and how investors will get their money back. So if you can give them a really clear picture on this is when we will make money and this is how we make money, and it's straightforward, you're probably halfway there.
Brilliant. That's really great advice. Thank you so much for being so open on it. What was that journey like? What was the early kind of 6 months? And at what stage did you decide, okay, I'm going to leave the job?
Oh, like I knew, like when Jamie and Helen were developing out the patent and like the, you know, doing the market research and we were kind of investigating it, I kind of thought, yeah, like if this patent files and we can get this technology, you know, I'm going to leave. You know, I just was so excited about the idea. So we spent the first 6 months, Jamie and I took a hot desk down in Dogpatch Labs, and that was absolutely brilliant because I was raising money and investors just, Dogpatch was kind of the first of its kind in terms of that kind of Silicon Valley feel, like investors would drop in and they just got a totally different experience to the kind of traditional finance, you know, financial companies and those type of offices. So it was kind of exciting for them to come in and see like lots of startups working in this kind of ecosystem. So we were there for 6 months and we, I literally just went to everything in town, like every event, every First Fridays, every Enterprise Ireland event, every Leo event, and just asked as many founders as I could, what do I do? How do I start? Where are the failures? Where are the challenges? And I kind of spent those 4 months in information gathering. And then I started to kind of get a picture, okay, we need Enterprise Ireland HPSU. We need to get these innovation vouchers. They're like investors typically, they love the Enterprise Ireland co-funding because, you know, it's they know that there's somebody else checking your accounts. It's a de-risking for all of the investors. If you've got, you know, then we moved to a bigger premises. And yeah, like we just, it was more just getting out in front of people and seeing the appetite and what did they want to see from us to get the money over the line. So yeah, like within maybe 6 weeks of raising or with starting the fundraising, we were oversubscribed at 900,000.
I'd say people loved you when you came back and you're like, thanks for that advice. We just closed the million. It's such an unusual story in Ireland, because generally it's a long, arduous process full of knockbacks. But I was fascinated to hear all the little social proof signals you were sending up there, from where you based yourself to who you surrounded yourself with to how you got the innovation vouchers. You were gathering social proof at every stage.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And like, when you can get the option of private money, it can be very easy to walk away from like other money, like, you know, that's a bit harder to apply for and like arduous application forms. But I think, as I say, it, like, you know, the investors loved that other people had been checking, like, you know, and Enterprise Ireland liked the look of our investors. So when people are like, I guess the only advice I can give around fundraising is to do it in a defined time period. I would do, like, it's a full time job, and that's all I did full time. And by the time the round closed and the paperwork, you're talking maybe 4 to 5 months. Like, that was my full time job. I did absolutely nothing else. And I think sometimes with companies where the founder, maybe it's the CTO, is trying to raise, I think that it can become very protracted. And then your news and your excitement and your investment proposal becomes a bit stale. The way I would approach it is like to try and do it in a set amount of time. This is the closing date, and do all your meetings and be very, very focused on it and do nothing else. And then, like, in addition to that, we won like a couple of competitions in that period. And although we only kind of do competitions because the media can be great about it, but typically, you know, it's good to do one when you're fundraising and to win. And then obviously to do one, maybe if you're launching a new product or service, it's great because you get this extra media attention, but certainly not to be doing them all the time. So there's kind of things like that that stand to you. And then they all kind of come together to give the investors like a bit of excitement and a bit of like the kick maybe to get the money over the line.
You're very strategic. Like, how you lay this out is incredibly interesting. I think it's definitely one of the best chats we've had about fundraising, and very clear, specific advice for people, because from chatting to founders, sometimes they get dragged down that road, and it can go on for years, and they're in this kind of limbo land then of being almost like a zombie company. They might only have a couple of people on the team, and the most important person, yourself, is then dragged down the fundraising. How did you, was this previous advice you'd gotten, or was this something from your own personal industry, your experience in finance, that you knew, okay, these are the parameters we need to work through here and not get distracted?
Typically, I would say we kind of came up with a plan, myself, Jamie and Helen, and we would read the same book. We tried to read the same books or listen to the same podcast. So like before, when we were kind of information gathering and I was down in Dogpatch, I was listening to all the Gimlets and, you know, the American kind of style, like how they raise, how quickly they raise, how much they raise. And then we were kind of comparing it to the European. And I think we just kind of came up with this plan. Like this is, we'll only spend this much time doing it. Because really, like for us, like even the prototype was going to cost a lot of money. So hardware, like the cliche, hardware is hard and it's expensive and it's, you know, it's capital intensive. So like if we didn't raise, we were going nowhere. So we either got the money and started the manufacturing and the molding and all the testing, or we were never getting out of the blocks. So in some ways, there was no choice. We just had to get the money and it had to be quick. Otherwise, we were sitting there like we had, you know, worked for our sweat equity, and now we needed to kind of get people on board. And, you know, the people who work with us are just so highly skilled. You know, they're biomedical engineers, industrial chemists. They're not, obviously not cheap in the market, and they're at the top of their education and their profession. And like these people have to be paid. So yeah, there was no real option. We just had to get the money and get going.
So at that stage, just before the close, it was yourself, Jamie and Helen. And then their money was going to finance the build out. Was it hard to convince the initial 1 to 2 to 3 people to join?
Well, Jamie and Helen and I are like the founders. Yeah. So we only, after that, we hired 2 very, very expert people. And no, I mean, it wasn't difficult, because I think the technology is so groundbreaking and so disruptive, and it's never been done before. So these people definitely have an appetite to do something, that to work on something truly innovative. And secondly, I would say they would, you know, they want to do something good for like mankind, and breastfeeding for baby mother and society, like that ethos, you know, to help mothers breastfeed for longer, if that's what they want to do. You know, some people like don't want to work in maybe gambling companies, or, you know, like they want to do something that in the end might make a difference. So, yeah, we to be honest, haven't found it difficult to find people.
So after the first 6 months, you raised, and then what was the next step for yourselves?
So the next step was we had to kind of bring the patent to kind of a working prototype. And so that meant building out a lab, building out our own test systems. That again, I say, cost money to have like all these kind of like 3D printers and ovens and all this equipment that I wouldn't even know the name of. I barely let myself go into the lab. I'm so terrified. So we spent the following 12 months doing that, but we knew at that stage then that, you know, for like Coral will go to the market as a consumer product, but what we really want is doctors, nurses, midwives, you know, lactation consultants, you know, recommending it, like being the gold standard in breastfeeding measurement. And we knew to achieve this that we needed to get public funding for a peer-reviewed clinical trial. So we spent a lot of that 12 months. We put a lot of work into the Horizon 2020 application. That's the European Commission's Horizon project, which is for the most disruptive, innovative technologies. And in the end of 2019, then we were awarded that. So that was a 2.1 million euro grant, and they don't take any equity. And so that was really for us to be able to, you know, carry out this clinical trial in one of the biggest maternity hospitals in Europe, and also then to scale up in the background, like to put that manufacturing capability in place. So we were absolutely thrilled, like, to be awarded that, because it was not easy. And as I say, you're in a pot with maybe 1,800 companies went Wow. into the call, and about 73 got funded. So we were one of the 73. So the competition and the scrutiny, the due diligence, the time that I put that application together was very intense. But obviously, when you're getting the money at the end of it, and it's essentially like free money, and your investors are getting that bump. Mm. So their bank, you know, the bank for their book is going longer all the time. And that was really important. So I'd say the following 12 to 18 months, we really focused on that.
So that was 2019. Talk me through that process a little bit. I know you're saying it's quite arduous. So huge amount of companies go in. How did you even hear about this? Like, how did you even discover this? Because there does seem to be quite a lot of access to funding in the EU, but it seems to be quite difficult to find out about it. So how did you find out, and how did you go down the process?
Yeah, I met Trish Scanlon from Soapbox Labs, and she had been a previous recipient of it. And she had said, look, the companies that go for this, you kind of need to hit three parameters, or don't bother like applying. But she felt that we were really suited to it. So one was that obviously it has to have a benefit to the European taxpayer, because it's European money. So your jobs and manufacturing in Europe. The second thing, that it could be globally scalable quickly. You know, they wanted the companies to be scaled quickly and internationally. And thirdly, that it has a societal impact. And so that's why you'll see a lot of companies, whether it's climate, nuclear, you know, there's just so many different, like, green, sustainable energies going for it. But we really felt that we could hit these three requirements, and we could hit them well. So, yeah, the application process has changed last year. I believe now you submit a video, and then if you don't get past that stage, then you don't put the application together. But the application was it was nearly 100 pages long, really, by the time we finished it. And,
wow.
Like, they have the 30 set pages, and then you can add in your additional information. We went through this application process. We scored over the score that was required. And then we went to Brussels to be interviewed by a panel of experts. So there was seven kind of experts across different fields, and you kind of go in like a jury system, and so was Jamie, Helen, and myself, and you're interrogated on all aspects of the application. And then it's just like a yes or a no.
Wow. How long, say, from start to finish?
From the application, like, if you applied and got it on the first time you ever entered, I think you would be talking about 6 months.
Okay.
Like, you know, it's a long enough process, because they get these thousands of very in-depth applications, and they need to be reviewed by evaluators across Europe. And yeah, it's quite, it's a heavy enough process for them even, you know, but obviously that's, they're hoping that they are making sure that they fund the correct companies.
Absolutely. And is there a set amount that you can go for, or is it just a set amount that's assigned to each company? Or can you say, we are looking for X amount of funding?
You can, I think, up to a level. I think the highest is maybe around 5 million. And then if you go in with the conglomerate of companies, it can go a little bit higher. So, but you really, like, you don't want to overestimate how much you need, or it might just be a no. Mm. You kind of have to be, like, your budgets have to be very tight. Like, obviously, they don't like waste, or, you know, you kind of go for what you need, really. And they are strict about what you can spend the money on as well. So you can't spend, say, for instance, any of the money on marketing or sales. So it is like a commercialization grant. So the, you know, the reporting around that, they're very careful around the reporting. And that's what I currently manage now, is the monthly, the figures and the audits. And yeah.
How did you transition across from industry, say a very specific job, this is your job, to being the CEO and co-founder? Like, how did you manage that process? How did you find it?
I loved it because my background was in financial services. I had moved around to different departments, and then, so I was client facing, and then I went into back office to lead teams, and then I went back, you know, into wealth management. But I loved working on projects. I would say I never really stayed not years and years in one department. In my 20s, I went back and I did an applied diploma in project management. And I kind of liked that type of work, like kind of jack of all trades, master of none. But I liked going out on projects if we were acquiring a business and folding it into the company. And then that was finished. I kind of liked that type of work. So it suited my personality. I would do it all again.
I think most entrepreneurs are like that. You get that buzz of the start, middle, end. And then if you do that in mini bursts, it kind of gives you that endorphins and that kick that you need to kind of go, okay, cool, on to the next thing. Your distraction, you don't get distracted too much, but you can get that endorphin from kind of start, middle, and end. So when you got the European money, what was it like? What was the feeling?
Relief.
It's a very honest answer. I love it.
Yeah, because really, because we had no product in the market, it wasn't ready. Like, I think, I'm not sure would we have been able to fundraise again, you know, because, you know, so this money was a great bump. And then what it meant was that we could raise a little bit more, but what we could do was really build a company for scale in the background. So that manufacturing capability. So we weren't kind of going, okay, we can, like, next year we'll be able to provide, you know, produce 10,000 units, and then we'll need to move to another manufacturer to. So what we're really trying to do in the background is build a company for scale, and that money allowed us to do it. So yeah, I'm not sure. Typically, like a lot of the Series A and the VCs, they want to see revenue before, like, once you've done a seed round, the next point that they want to see is revenue, and they won't back anything after that. Back anything before that. So yeah, we were delighted, but we were really relieved. And our investors were really happy. And then obviously it opened up the whole academic medical side of things for us. So, you know, obviously, Cora, we want mothers who need it to be able to go out and buy it and access it. But, you know, on the academic and medical side of things, there's a huge amount of research studies that can be conducted now using the Coro, which were never been able to be completed before. So, like, looking at the external factors that impact breast milk supply. So, for instance, does a mother's BMI impact her supply? Or if a mother is on medication, like diabetes medication, does this impact her supply? So for the first time ever, Coro is, like, in this environment where, you know, this data being recorded and being disseminated around, you know, in those environments is really, really important. So we kind of have the dual trajectory, and both are important. But getting the money for a publicly funded trial, that really opened up that area for us in the medical world.
Yeah, it's mind blowing. It really is tip of the spear stuff when you explain there the data that's going to be uncovered. Like, this was just all hidden, I guess. This was all just unknown. Like, even you were telling me about it earlier, about weighing the nappies and then wearing the baby. like, it's so complex and so arduous and so prone to error. I'd imagine the stuff that you guys are about to uncover, and I'm sure uncovering right now, it must just be mind-blowing for scientists and people like yourself to be able to look into it now and go, wow, this is something we'd never even discovered before.
Yeah, and in terms of our clinical trial, like, we have recorded data recently that was never seen before, and that is being... that's novel, and, you know, is being disseminated at one of the largest conferences, midwifery conferences in the world next month. So, but again, it's not volume, and it's not what the commercial sense or what we want that to do. But all the time, we feel like we're adding value. And I think maybe that the Commission are happy with that, the European Commission. They continue to give us their support and to extend our project deadline, which was fantastic, given all of the global issues everyone's experienced. But yeah, we'll keep trucking at it.
So we'll talk about it briefly. Did COVID impact yourselves and what you were working on?
No, it just meant that the clinical trial had to be paused in the hospital when they couldn't take in the devices, our product. But in terms of what we are doing, no, like, our focus is still exactly as it was 5 years ago, and what we want to achieve.
What does, for anyone that's listening who doesn't know, what does a clinical trial involve?
So a clinical trial, Helen is our chief research officer, so I'm not a medical professional, but I'll give you...
just a broad overview for the person on the street. Language. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so you need to partner with a hospital, or typically through either a university or like an RCSI, and there has to be like a lead on the project. So whether that's, in our case, paediatrician or... doctors, obviously, that are focused in that area, and that's their area of expertise. And they typically have they're aligning with you because they have a certain piece of work that they want to research and that they want to develop further. So the thing about a clinical trial that's publicly funded is that, you know, we don't have any say in, like, if it doesn't work, they're going to publish that. Like, you are at arm's length, and they, you know, you're paying them to do the work, and they publish the data. So, you know, it's very interesting. It's fascinating. But like that, I mean, doctors, that's what doctors and nurses who hopefully will eventually recommend our product, that's what they'll want to see. They'll want to see that it was used in this environment under these protocols, which are widely accepted in the medical industry. So yeah, it's typically, like, our project will be probably run to 24 months. So like, that's a good project. So it's a long time as well, you know, but like everything, a medical device takes a long time. I think most medical device companies that might be coming out of, you know, the west of Ireland is so rich in that landscape. You know, you're talking 10, 12, 15 years, because, you know, if these devices are going inhuman, or it takes a long time to get those tests and trials up and running. Unfunded.
Yeah. How do you maintain the intensity and maintain the high level that you're working at all the time when you are looking at such a long horizon?
I think, like, for me, like, in terms of my role really at the moment, is I'm the only non-technical, non-scientist, non-engineer on the team. So, like, my role is really just to take the noise away from them. So what do they need to do to get their work done? Do they need money? Do they need a connection into another company? They don't need to be doing, like, arduous reporting, you know, to whoever that might be, filling out paperwork. So typically for me, it's just taking as much away from them so they can just focus on the technology and focus on whether it's the trial. And so that's kind of how we keep going. But again, like, it sounds pretty it sounds basic, but like, burn rate and money, like, you'll work as fast as you need to because you know your money could run out. And I guess that's just the nature of startups, and if people don't tell you that, they're probably not being honest.
So how do you plan your, I ask a lot of entrepreneurs this because I'm fascinated by it. How do you plan, say, your week, your month, your quarter, your year? Do you have a process for breaking that down? How do you make sure it all gets done?
Yeah, like typically like today, I would spend maybe 2 to 3 days in the office, and then that's just the paperwork, the accounts, whatever I need to get done. And then I'll spend the rest of the time and schedule all my meetings back to back. So if I'm in the city, I could end up, you know, having like 6 or 7 coffees and trying to meet up with people, whether it's my network or the investors, just keeping in front of people. Then if it's a larger scale project like a fundraise, I'll typically give that 6 to 8 months. And I kind of, having the experience of the seed, I kind of know how long that can take. And, you know, just in terms of travel and getting in front of investors and getting their answer, you get a lot of people who say, look, love the idea, come back to me when you've got 250 and I'll think about it then. So I, you know, it can be very hard. The initial shoe leather can be very intense. Like, you can be meeting, you know, a lot of people, and they want to stay interested, but they can't give you an answer until other people go in first. So you've a lot of following up and staying relevant to people, staying on top of their mind and staying out there. So yeah, you can be on the road a lot when you're fundraising. And then if I have reporting to Europe, I'll give myself 2 or 3 weeks and say, I have to get this done. And then I just sit down and get through it. So yeah, it's a job. There's so many different jobs, but I just try and break it down into the actual job as opposed to time.
How do you touched on it briefly there, staying front of mind with people. What's your kind of strategy, or what's your plan for that? Because that can be a very difficult thing. You're trying to, some people are in, if this person is in, and if that person's in, they're in. How do you manage that chain, that knock-on chain of fundraising?
I mean, I think all of our investors were extremely, they're extremely helpful. They're angels. A lot of them are professional investors, so they understand. They understand this process. They understand the risk-reward profile involved. They understand that, you know, when you say it's going to take 2 years, it's going to take 4 years. So, you know, they were quite understanding in that way, and they just let us get on with it. They just say, look, call me if you ever need anything. But they also introduced me to their network. So I think if you can get one or two really good people on board at the start, it kind of it trickles out. And they'll make the introductions for you. I mean, we can't, like in Ireland, everyone has been so generous with their investor book, you know, even like different law firms, and they'd say, look, what do you need? Who do you need to get in front of? And like in that way, being in Ireland and being small is a real benefit. It's a real advantage because you're really only one person away. Like if I wanted to meet somebody, I probably could just call you and say, do you know this person? Do you know this, you know, entrepreneur who scaled in America, put in an introduction for me, and people do it. I did spend a bit of time in London meeting with other startups, and it was quite disjointed there. They didn't, like, obviously it's such a bigger country, and you're never that one degree of separation from someone. So it was harder for them to get in touch with people. So yeah, I would say, just use your network. Like it sounds kind of, it doesn't sound very helpful, but that's how we did it.
Well, it's generally the obvious answer, isn't it? It's that law of simplicity. Like, it's generally the most obvious answer is the answer. How do you manage your relationship with investors? Like, how do you, like, what is involved in that? Because I think for a lot of startups, they're unsure. Are they an investor? Are they going to be a mentor? Like, do they make it clear to you, or do you make it clear to them?
So we made it clear for our seed round. And then we obviously had the European money. So we haven't taken on any more investors since then. But we kind of just said, look, we know what we need to do, and we need the time and space to do it. We're at that stage where, you know, bringing on board investors or institutional money, it's not relevant for us right now. Obviously, as we grow and launch and scale, then our company changes. But for where we are at the moment, we just needed money, and we kind of needed the time and space. But it was always very warm. It was always like, we contact them, we give them their quarterly update. And obviously they're all experienced in different areas, and they say, look, if you need anything, call us. But yeah, I would definitely try and get out and meet them face to face at least twice a year, even just for a coffee or a chat. That was a little bit more difficult, obviously, over COVID. So I've kind of just started to go back out and see them again. And yeah, it's quite informal for us because, as I said, there is no institutional money involved. And, you know, we never miss that quarterly update though. Like, you know, that's really sacrosanct for them to know that you're still there in touch, even if you don't have much to report, just to have it there for them. So, we have a very much an open door policy, like call me if you have any questions. And if you want to come in and see the lab, come in and see it. But yeah, for the most part, they're just happy to let us get through the next phase that we need to of the product finalization.
It sounds like you've got a great bunch of people behind you. As you touched on there, consistency really is the secret to most things, isn't it? Like the more you're in business, the more you realize, just be consistent, turn up and do a reasonable job and be pretty consistent with things.
Yeah, and tell the truth, even if it's ugly, you know, like it's if you're delayed or if something goes wrong, like people understand, like they understand the type of investment this is. Mm. And yeah, so we would say just be warts and all, just be honest.
I love that phrase. It's better to be punched by the truth than kissed by a lie. It's one I keep in my mind all the time. What does the next kind
exactly
6 to 12 to 24 months look like for yourselves?
So we're currently in one of our, like, hopefully one of our final testing cycles. And so we have more tooling being made, more testing. Obviously, our testing cycles are long. You know, this product is going into a baby's mouth. So it's not, it's so different to software. People are like, oh, release version one and then you can release version two. But really, obviously, yeah, this has to be perfect. So, we've there's a lot of testing around that, obviously. And so get that done over the next, I'd say, 6 to 9 months with potential launch into Ireland and the UK early next year. That would be the aim as it stands now.
Brilliant. So what... Beyond that, then, what are you hoping for in the future? What are your kind of goals for CoreFlow? Because it sounds like a company really on the tip of something phenomenal.
I guess for us, like, what really changed with us over between the mothers that we would have met 5 years ago and the mothers nowadays and COVID is how we plan to sell. So initially, we were, you know, the complex structures of pharmacy retail, like that, you know, it is quite complex between distributors and into pharmacies, and then you've got your margins. So like what the mothers we initially spoke to, they said, look, I want to go into a pharmacy. Pharmacies have very high trust rates in Ireland, and I want to speak to a sales professional about how it works. They want to go in and touch and feel it. And like we have these point display stands where they can pick up the silicone. So that education piece, because at the moment there is no alternative to formula or the breastfeeding other than formula. So like a product like ours has never existed. So there's a huge education piece around it. And a lot of mothers, unless they've been using Shields for skin protection, they might not know about them. So we really felt like the pharmacies were best placed to kind of give that information. And again, they can go in and touch the Shield and pick it up and feel the weight of it and look at the app and test the app. But absolutely, since it's probably a mix between COVID and the younger generation coming up, like the millennials and even younger, when we do our surveys, they have absolutely no problem buying Coro online. And that has been a radical change in like the last 5 years. So we interviewed, say, 200 mothers under the age of 30 in France, and 47% of them said they would automatically go online to buy it. They wouldn't even consider walking to a shop. We also saw that difference, urban and rural areas, that women in urban areas more likely to buy online. In rural, there was a slight increase in women who wanted to go into a shop. So our business model that we'd like to see over the next few years is to obviously be available in like the bigger pharmacy chains, but not in everyone. And then to really push Coro through the e-commerce platforms that are open to us. And that's been quite a change even since we started. So yeah, we want to launch and we want to kind of commercialize through at least 5 geographies in Europe. And then obviously America and China are the biggest markets for our product. And we know that. So I guess at that point, towards the end of next year, we'll be looking at a funding round to be able to do that type of scale.
That's really interesting. And there's a great lesson there in always being fluid and always being adaptive to your market. Because if you had just stuck with the head down, go, no, this is the only way it's going to work. But the fact that I think that's true for a lot of industries now. I think a lot of people have changed their buying habits over COVID. I think once you try the convenience of certain things, you're like, well, why? It is what it is. Why would I now go and traipse in? Especially for repeat purchases. I think a lot of people have now gone, well, I just set that up on repeat and it just arrives to the house and it's just much easier.
Exactly. Now, Coro is it's a one product. You know, the mother, it's a shield, will stand over it for its durability for 6 months. That's the same as a standard shield. It's already on the market. And it's a once-off purchase. I mean, we were asked, by a lot of VCs, oh, this is a perfect subscription as a service, like to charge mothers for their own breastfeeding data. But that is something we absolutely won't do. So the mother will have access to her app, all the analytics on the app, feed profiles. She can track it over previous days, weeks and months, switch between left breast and right breast and look at lots of other really interesting information about how her baby is feeding. But certainly when a mother buys the Coro, she's getting the shield and she's getting her data, and there's no subscription, unfortunately, which isn't the sexiest thing nowadays, but it's something that we feel very strongly about. And obviously breastfeeding mothers would probably feel very strongly about it as well.
It's brilliant. It's such a, there's so many layers to the product. What, if you were chatting to Roseanne of 5 years ago, what would you say to her?
Probably raise more at the start. I think a lot of people, I think that's probably very common. I mean, we set out to raise 250 and we raised 900, but even at that, I think if I had the chance again, I'd raise a little bit more. Like, that was oversubscribed. So, that's probably a very common trait of the first startup entrepreneur, though.
I think it is. And it's always like, you don't know what you don't know. And people are like, well, I couldn't raise more because this is all we had and this is all we thought we could get. So how would you overcome that? How would you get over that mental block in your head? Because this is very common advice, but I think people are like, oh, it's very easy for her to say, but would you overcome that? How would you say, look, Roseanne, it's okay. This is what you need to reframe it as.
That global ambition, like that, think bigger, but also it's more about if I had a clear understanding of how much time it took to raise money and, you know, that confidence I had that we were going to get the Horizon grant first time, you know, really, it took us more than that. But yeah, I would say it's a confidence thing. And when you realize how long it's going to take you to raise the next round, it's just such a time consuming process. And if you're, as I said, if you're the CTO or if you have another job in the business, you'll take money quicker. You'll take it earlier. You'll take more if you have it. Like, we turned down money in that seed round. And now, we, you know, it was fine because of the way things worked out for us in terms of our funding. But for other startups, and when I meet them, I'm kind of saying, no, if the money's on the table at the start, take it, because you just never understand the true costs. Now, maybe if it's your second or third startup, you understand how expensive things are. But certainly, don't underestimate how quickly the money runs out.
It's savage advice. What are your tips for working with co-founders, especially three in the business? What are your tips for working and working with family, I guess? What would your non-negotiables be for working with co-founders?
So for us, three works as a number because we just vote on everything. So, you know, it can be Jamie and Helen voting against me and Helen voting against Jamie, but we just typically take a vote and it's done. You know, we don't, it's just, that's the way we do it. And it's actually worked very well. I think just, and then obviously appreciating other people's time and, you know, have the hard conversations if you have to have them. But I think at the very beginning, like up front, maybe more so if it's a very close friend or family, is having those, your shareholders agreements, everything, like all the paperwork really tied down and have that super tight, the legals. Because certainly from my previous jobs, you'd see that's where a lot of things come away at the seams, is where there's been a sloppy documentation at the beginning, and then it affects the cap table, it affects personal relationships, it affects potential acquisition or buyout. And like most of the time when you come down to it, something just wasn't documented properly, or it wasn't clear to all people involved. So I think everyone having a very clear role, having a very clear understanding of their position in the company, and then including, and that goes like not just for the founder, the founding team and employees, but also for the investors. You know, companies giving a board seat to an investor, but not really knowing what they're adding, or maybe the company isn't at the correct stage. So yeah, I'd be all about the paperwork, actually, Gary, if I'm honest.
Look, if I had a euro for every time a founder told me that messy paperwork had tripped them up, I wouldn't even have to work anymore. It's the most common issue because everyone's full of the joys of spring at start, right? Everyone's like, oh, this is so exciting, and we're best pals and we're going to take over the world and all that stuff. And then you know, 2 years down the line, life circumstances change, you know, interest peaks, troughs, whatever it is, what you'd recommend? Legal documents straight away. Is there any good tips you'd give around that kind of partnership document?
Yeah, I would say, look, there's a couple of solicitors in town. I think they're absolutely amazing. Maura Cunningham in Beecham's and Deirdre McCarthy in Maples, brilliant women, and they know this area. Like, certainly for us, Maura has a very good working relationship with Enterprise Ireland. So I think any solicitor who knows Enterprise Ireland and their what they require if you're getting matched funding and that type of paperwork and can manage those lead-in times for you. In terms of the paperwork, so you've got your company constitution, you've got your shareholders agreement, and if you have a lot of investors in your seed round, consider the nominee. Consider nominee agreements, so your investors then are one line on your cap table. It's nice and clean, and you know, that'll stand to you in the future rather than having 30 or 40 people on your cap table, particularly at a seed stage when it's small, relatively small amounts of money. And it can actually, you know, work in your favour because you can take on small amounts of money, the fives, the tens, the twenties in your seed round. So I would recommend speaking to somebody about that. So they'd be the documents that the main ones, I think.
Brilliant.
That the people need to consider. Oh, the other thing I'd say is there are some companies in town, law firms, they say, oh, they'll charge you a percentage of what you raise in terms of your legal fees. And I would obviously say, don't do that. Just agree a fixed price for the job and then pay that. And that's that.
Much cleaner. Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah, there seems to be a few kind of things at the minute. People are asking for X percentage of intros and all that kind of stuff. It's very messy and very murky. So that's super advice. Just pay the invoice. Just pay the $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is and just be done with it. They're great recommendations. Thank you so much.
Yeah, just
for
set
that.
Your price at the start.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, set your price and then just pay it and be done with it.
Yeah, nice and clean. I'll put the two recommendations in the show notes because that's a question that is brought up a lot about partnership agreements. So brilliant. Finally, is there a book that's going to help you on the journey, either personally or professionally?
So I think I was thinking of the two books that were very helpful for us. Obviously, I don't know if anyone has set up Venture Deals by Brad Fells and James Mendelsohn.
Don't think so.
It's, you know, obviously the fundraising can be tricky and different terms, different investors, what they look for. And they really make this book, even some of the most technical detail, and they make it very easy because they're just giving examples. And it's fantastic because it's all stories of people who got it wrong or didn't understand a term or condition. And I think it's brilliant, very easy to read. And then there's one book called The Checklist Manifesto.
Sure. I read that. It's super.
I thought
so good. Yeah.
It's super. Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of that's kind of stood with me for some reason. Yeah. So they'd be my two.
That is a super book. I love that book. It's so, so good. You can really do it rereading because it's so simple. It's so, so simple, but it's filled with just the basics are always the best. Roseanne, where can people learn a little bit more about CoralFlow?
So we are at coralflow.com and we're obviously on the usual social media platforms, but we're there and our contact details are there, and hopefully now you'll see more of us early next year. As I said, we're kind of staying under the radar for now.
Perfect. I've absolutely no doubt we're going to be seeing a lot more about this. I love this idea. Listen, thank you so much for chatting to me. It was a great chat.
Thanks, Gary. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Roseanne. I'm sure you got as much out of it as I did. I will see you back here in a couple of weeks for season 9. In the meantime, go back and let me know what your favorite episode of season 8 was. You can follow me on all social media at Mr. Gary Fox. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you back here in a couple of weeks.